Havdalah is the gracious ceremony which separates the end of the Sabbath from the work week. Mavdil bin Kodesh Lechol. We bless the wine, we recite the Kiddush. Some fragrance is passed around, the last blessed sniff of the Sabbath should remain with us throughout the week. The candle which is burned throughout the long day is extinguished. The Hebrew word root, dalet lamed, means to separate or to distinguish. We are told that Israel was given the covenant, the laws, in order to distinguish Israel from all other peoples, that we would be a holy people. Hivdalti etchem mikol ha'amim. And in common speech, phenomenon of the same order, but to suggest that there were differences in quality or in kind, this verb badal would be used. Thus, when a speaker referred to the living dead in the same sentence, he would say after the name of the living person, Yibadel lechayim, may he be separated out for long life. And when we distinguished between items of the same kind as the quality of the work, we added the phrase lahavdil, let there be a clear understanding that this is to be distinguished. So in the sentence, Martin Luther King and Jim ministers in the civil rights movement. Or this sentence, the Johnstown commune, rural utopian communes. Now the ability to make discriminatory judgments, to separate out items, objects, phenomenon of the same general a distinction among them as to quality, as to worth, is the beginning of wisdom. One of the things that has troubled me most about all the spate of material which has come out as to the garish events in Jonestown is that they have tended to treat the events as a thing in itself, a pathological aberration of society. And what I'd like to suggest this morning is that we will not be able to understand the people until we are prepared to accept the sentence, the temple, St. John's Cathedral, the Church of the Covenant, and Lahavdil, the temple, institutions. And each reflects religious concerns and expresses a religious spirit. For the distinction which is to be made is not religious, and they are a cult, something different, something set apart, that religions are good and cults are bad, or religions are benevolent and cults are malevolent. All these institutions which are religious in nature are of the same general order, lahavdil, but there are distinctions to be made. Content, these distinctions are critical and crucial. But the first basis for understanding, the foundation for understanding Johnstown, is simply this. Religious experience. It involves that which we call religion. Now this is very difficult for most Americans to understand.
Do you think of religion as essentially a humanistic undertaking?
We've been a prosperous nation. We've been a powerful nation. The mainline religious traditions in America have all been social action, social gospel.
The main
activities of religion in America have involved training up the young in morals, providing counsel for the disturbed and the anxious, providing activity for the aging. All of these commendable undertakings. We have really, to a certain degree, taken our faith for granted. Americans are not strong on theology or dogma. We've had proof and proof again of the rightness of our dogma, of that which we take for granted but lies at the very basis of our being, in our power, in our prosperity, in the success of our way of life. And so we've not had to challenge it too deeply. There are dogmas, there are articles of faith within each of our souls. Religion, dear friends, is not good, nor is religion bad. It simply is. And it matters a great deal what religion you affiliate with, what set of values, of axioms, of basic assumptions lie within your soul. It made a great deal of difference, didn't it, that the 900 and some odd who drank the cyanide in Jonestown belonged to the People's Temple and not to another congregation of the Disciples of Christ. It matters a great deal whether our young people involve themselves in a Torah core camp situation or in one of the love bombings of the Moonies. It matters a great deal is whether or not the tradition with which we affiliate ourselves emphasizes the fitness of the individual spirit to make religious assumptions and judgments, or it emphasizes authority, subservience, kissing the ring of the religious leader. You may remember some 10 years ago or so, there was a great campaign sponsored by one of these civic groups, perhaps the Advertising Council. All across America, there suddenly appeared billboards on which was the sign, "It matters not where you go on Sunday, just go." And in the background, there was a dome, and there was a spire, and a number of other kinds of distinguishable ecclesiastical roof lines. It matters a great deal where you go. And the same religious congregation, the same religious community can be different from era to era. When the People's Temple was in Indianapolis, it was a community of dedicated people who believed in democracy, who believed in integration, who believed in communism, who believed much as Jesus probably believed 2,000 years ago. And one can almost trace the change in this movement from an event which has been reported as having occurred in 1961. An assistant minister who saw this event as his moment of removal, of dismissal, reports that at that time, Reverend Jones took a Bible and threw it on the floor, saying, "They're more interested in this than in me." A change. The People's Temple had now began to worship the leader rather than God himself. Now, in America, we have assumed that religion deals with God. We've assumed that one measures religion by affiliation with a congregation. We recognize that most affiliation is tepid, lukewarm. It does not really involve any significant personality difference or emotional difference between those who are affiliated and those who are not affiliated. And so we can't imagine anybody willing to die for their faith. But let me remind you that religion is not affiliation with a religious institution, that religious movements do not have to affirm God. Indeed, the greatest religious movements, the most revolutionary and successful religious movements of the 19th and 20th century are atheistic. Communism, Maoism, Nazism. And they are classic religions because they make certain assumptions about life. And they create the rituals and the holidays and the mass moments in which one reaffirms one's commitment to these basic assumptions and basic values. What is religion? Religion is a universal phenomenon. You are religious, though you may not even acknowledge it. It is the result of the fact that we are conscious, that we are awake, that alone of all the things that live, human beings are aware that they are alive. All other Living things respond instinctively to life. They take life for granted. They simply try to survive. We begin to wonder about life. We are thrust into existence. We are born. And we become aware through childhood and adolescence that there is something which is life itself. And we begin to wonder what it is. And then we notice that life is full of contradictions, that life is brief, that life is bruising, that there's injustice in human society, that some have more, some have less, some are born with more talent, brain power, emotional sensitivity, others with less. We begin to wonder what life is and what death is and what's the purpose of it all and whether in fact what we believe to be right is right. Every human being is religious because every human being is conscious of being aware, conscious of being alive. And because we have to resolve the contradiction between what we experience and what we think ought to be done, because we need salvation, because we need to feel that there is a way that we ought to live, that we do live, which gives meaning to life and purpose to life and grace to life and direction to life, which confirms that which we tend to assume. At the very basis of religion lies an emotional need to feel that we are living significantly. The key terms in religion are deliverance, salvation, redemption. And they don't mean simply life in the hereafter, getting into heaven. It means, in a humanistic religion, there's awareness, the sense, the certainty, the confidence that what I am doing has meaning, is dignified, is worthy of me, is right. And how do I know that? And the answer is there's no way of really knowing, proving that the way I live, the values which are mine, are right and fitting and immutable and good. And at the basis of all religions is what the psychologists call the will to believe. Because these questions are not simply dispassionate questions, theoretical questions, questions which are asked coolly and can be answered coolly. They are questions which are asked out of desperate need. And if we are satisfied with the answers, they give coherence to our lives, and we will not let loose of them because we have gambled our lives upon them. The very basis of religion, of Judaism, Christianity, of Islam, of Buddhism, of Marxism, of Maoism, and yes, of the Moonies, the cults, the People's Temple, lies a set of accepted answers, accepted emotionally, accepted on faith, which give a sense of fitness, of coherence, a redemptive sense to the way in which the disciples, the members, the communicants live. And that's why at its very base, religion is emotional. There's no such thing as a rational faith. After we have the faith, we reason about it. And because we are not only conscious but reasonable people, we can sometimes reason ourselves out of unreasonable commitments. But at the very basis of our faith lies a set of unprovable axioms, assumptions about human dignity, human worth, love, society, value, consciousness, purpose, the future, life and death, what lies beyond the grave. All people are religious, though obviously all do not go to a synagogue or to a church. The religious need is universal. And for those for whom the religious spirit burns intensely, those who have not settled comfortably into their religion but are searching for meaning, who feel that they have a truth which is not yet comprehended, understood by the larger society, those people burn with an intensity which more comfortable religionists tend to call fanaticism. But there's no way of reasoning them out of their, quote, fanaticism. For one man's fanaticism is the other man's principle. I often find that I think of somebody as a fanatic when I can't argue him around to my point of view. And if we believe that there are principles in life, and if we believe in commitment to these principles, at what point does commitment and principle add up to fanaticism? Very difficult question. Now, many have been troubled by the fact that the people in Jonestown not only went out to found Zion, to establish a socialist, fraternal, rural commune, but that they were willing, ultimately, to commit suicide. Now, let me make a lahavdil, a distinction, but one which comes out of our own tradition, but which may help us understand why I, for one, find it very easy to understand why, how these people committed suicide. Oh, yes, I know that some seem to have fought against it, that there were goons in the People's Temple who shot those who pulled back at the last moment, but I suspect, knowing what I do of religious movements of ecstasy, that most of these people willingly, calmly drank the Kool-Aid and the cyanide. Now, why? Many of you have been on top of Matsada. It's a rugged peak down in the valley of the Dead Sea. It's a beautiful, sere sight. It's become one of the great religious shrines of modern Israel. And that itself is a fascinating, is of interest. Because Matsada, until 1948 or 1950, had no meaning whatsoever to the Jewish people. Matsada was, the palace there was built by Herod, one of the hated tyrants of our history. The people who fought against the Romans on the top of Matsada and who committed suicide there violated Jewish law. Because you are not to commit suicide unless you are commanded to go out and to do something which will destroy another's life. No one in all of our history until the last 30 years thought of Matsada as a holy place. Why did it suddenly emerge as a holy place? I can understand how it emerged as a tourist attraction. The scenery is beautiful. There are old ruins there. It's an interesting climb up the side. But why did it emerge as a holy place? It emerged as a holy place because there were 100 million Arabs out there who were talking about jihad, a holy war, to drive the Israelis into the sea. Because there were the few here who felt threatened, who were threatened, whose way of life, all that they valued, was being put on the line. And they needed a myth. They needed a moment of ritual which would allow them to imagine what it would be like if they, in fact, had to lay down their lives and which said to themselves, I am willing to lay down my life to defend what I feel to be right. And that's why the paratroopers of the Israeli army climb Matsada and receive their wings in a firelight ceremony on top of the mountain. It's a pledge of willingness to die for my country. What greater gift has a man but to lay down his life for his people, for those who are threatened? The last time I was on top of Matsada, I saw a Hasidic Jew bring up a Sefer Torah for some American child's bar mitzvah on top of the hill there, what's believed to be a little synagogue. And I thought to myself, how far we have come and how bizarre, in a sense, life is. Here, a fortress built by a tyrant, which has no place in our tradition, is consecrated not by the Torah itself, but because it plays a role in modern Jewish life, which speaks of the desperation under which part of the Jewish people live. When you are desperate enough, giving up your life is not the worst of all possible consequences. These people were few. They had been conditioned to believe that they were threatened by investigation, by exposure from abroad, by the enemy, by satanic forces. They believed in the rightness of what they did. They were Christian, Christians who have been told in one way or another from the beginning that Christianity is built on the blood of martyrs. I can imagine the myth that was woven for them of how, if they had to die, their death would be a consecration from which the greater church of the people's temple would be built. I'm not at all surprised that there were white knights, a series of rehearsals for this final ghastly event, and that they drank the Kool-Aid those nights as willingly as they drank the cyanide the final night. Because what is it that they would have given up if the commune had been destroyed? That which is more precious than life itself, a vision, a sense of purpose, their own integrity, their own humanity, that which gave each of their lives meaning. Again, Elhabdil, imagine a Martian, one who's not like us, coming down and reading history, and coming upon the history of Jews in the Middle Ages, and reading there the long, sad chronicle of the martyrs, how in all the communities of Rhineland during the Crusades, Jewish community after Jewish community was destroyed as infidel, as heathen. He would have asked a simple question, I believe, this Martian. Why didn't these Jews simply accept baptism? They'd be alive. The water doesn't reach the soul. It'd have been the same after baptism as before. Logically, coolly, why didn't they save their lives? Why were they so stubborn? And the answer is simple. Because had they converted, they would have given up all that had meaning in their lives. They wouldn't have been alive anymore. That which was at the very center of their being, their sense of dignity, their sense of being a chosen people, their sense of witnessing to God, their sense of family, their sense of amour propre, of self, all this would have been destroyed by the act of conversion. They would have given themselves up. And that's more than giving up one's life. And so they became martyrs. Faith is a powerful, powerful current, emotional current. Be honest with yourself. Can you not conceive if this society were to go into convulsions? If our vaunted security and prosperity and power were to disappear? If suddenly we were ruled by those who demanded our thoughts and our loyalties and our acceptance of their political way, their economic theories, their assumptions about value, that we too might make some desperate stand for the values, the dignity, the sense of self which we now enjoy, knowing that that stand could not win out, that we would probably be destroyed, killed in the process. Religion is neither good nor bad. It depends on what convictions we take unto ourselves, what commitments we make, and how we institutionalize those commitments. Unfortunately, the news media have made a distinction which has no basis in fact. They have distinguished cults, the people we don't like, the Moonies, the Church of God, the Maharishi movements, from religions, the mainline traditions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, which are supposedly benevolent, to be accepted in all of their aspects. Now, I remind you that the People's Temple remained an accredited member of the denomination, the mainline denomination, Disciples of Christ, until the very end. Cults are simply groups of religious people who are a little more intense than ordinary groups of religious people. The difference between a cult and a religion is not one of substance, because there are good cults and there are pathological cults, but one of intensity. The cults care. Most religious people don't care quite as much, and that's the difference. The cults take the religious teaching seriously. And most who are affiliated with religion take religious teachings with a good grain of salt. That's the difference. In the history of mankind, every culture, every tradition, every part of the world in every age has had cults. Cults exist like the sunstorms, when suddenly the sun seems to erupt. There's sometimes when there are more eruptions, sometimes less, but there are always the sense of power leaving the source. Whenever the mainline traditions cool down, or whenever the society seems to be convulsed, the cults appear, reappear, demanding a transvaluation of values, demanding a new commitment to God, or a new commitment to idealism, a new commitment to mankind, or to justice, or to poverty, or to some other set of values. In the history of the world, some cults are like Jonah's gourd. They appear in the night and disappear in the night. Others abort, others explode. A very few emerge and become mainline religions. I assure you that when Jesus was with his disciples, the good people of the Galilee looked upon them as the most bizarre of cults. And I assure you that when the Pharisees first emerged, from which all of rabbinic Judaism develops, and refused to eat at any other table but that of a Pharisee, good burghers of Jerusalem looked upon the Pharisees as the most bizarre, an obtuse and difficult cult. Now, what distinguished the Jesus followers, the early Pharisees, as a cult? They took their religion seriously. Jesus believed that the kingdom of God was at hand, that the world was coming to end. The Pharisees believed that all Jews were priests, that there was to be a democracy and not a hierarchy in the Jewish tradition. And they acted on those beliefs. And that's the key. Cult people are committed. Most of us use our religious institution for congregation, for encouragement, for a pat on the back, to be, for once in a while to come, to be reassured that we're doing the right thing. But it really doesn't touch the living center of our lives. And nothing I've said should be construed in any way as suggesting that this cult, which is involved in the People's Temple, was benevolent or useful or to be approved. But I ask you to understand how religious people, that is, people like us, could become involved with a group such as that. The problem with the People's Temple was not its founding ideas. There's a certain noble ring to them. But like so many cults, they are magnetized by a single individual, a great leader, who ultimately comes to sense his power and is corrupted by that power. Those cults which tend to survive and to emerge are usually marked by the fact that the founder dies young. That's the most blessed event that can happen to a cult. Jesus died young. Many of the cult leaders died before corruption could enter their soul. But imagine what would have happened to the People's Temple if, let's say, a year ago, on one of his trips from San Francisco to Guyana, the Reverend Jim Jones's plane had gone down in that jungle landing strip and he'd been killed. The kibbutz was there. Part of the community was in Zion. There was a farm. There were survivors. There probably would have been a struggle for power. Ultimately, in the history of cults, that's the most important moment in the life of a community. It depends upon the quality of the people that emerge as the new leaders, dedicated now not to the person, but to the memory of the person, which is a different thing, and not to the person, but to the ideals for which he supposedly stood. A legend would have emerged about Jim Jones. He would become a great Moses figure, a great Jesus figure, a great Buddha figure. And if the society had been successful and had ultimately moved out and converted to the peoples of Guyana or others to their community, you ultimately would have had a mainline religion. And no one would have known that this kind of violence, suicidal violence, was part and parcel of the possibilities which had existed. Let me give you a for instance. Out here on Route 306, there's a temple in Kirtland. It's the Mormon temple. Joseph Smith's life and that of Jim Jones are remarkably similar. Joseph Smith, who was the founder of the Latter-day Church of Jesus Christ, was a young man who lived in Upper New York State near Palmyra in the Finger Lake District. He came into his adolescence in the late 1810s and early 20s. This was a period of time when Upper New York State was near the frontier, when it was a lonely place, didn't have settled institutions. Most of those who had come were those who had not been able to make out in New England and along the Atlantic seaboard. The people there were the less capable, the less literate, the less educated. And young Joseph Smith was the eighth of nine children. He was a tall lad, a good-looking lad, a lad with a gift of gab. He was a lad who loved to mimic the evangelical preachers who spoke here and there throughout the countryside. He had one special talent, a charisma, if you will. The great sport in Upper New York State was peering at stones. If they would find a piece of quartz, a translucent or opaque stone, they would look at it as if they were a crystal ball. And the man who had charisma would take that crystal ball and he would lead groups of people out into the woods so that they would know, led by this crystal ball, where it was that the Spaniards had buried their gold. And this was the great talent of Joseph Smith. Until one day he had an adolescent conversion experience, and an angel began to speak with him. And the angel ultimately led him to some golden tablets, which he alone saw, written in some archaic script, which he alone could interpret. And for 4 years, he translated what became the Book of the Mormon. And so fascinated were the country folk, and so in need of community, and so convinced that the values of thrift and integrity and hard work and shared labor and neighborliness, which were implicit in the Book of the Mormon, that they thronged to this young man who led them away from their ancestral home to Zion. If you can imagine Kirtland, Ohio being Zion. And there they pooled their money and they bought large tracts of land. And their power began to corrupt the soul of young Joseph Smith, and he organized a bank with the money that he had taken from his people. The only problem was he forgot to get a charter for the bank. And when the bank went bankrupt and many who had invested the bank began to want to lynch young Mr. Smith, he decamped, not from California to the city, but from Kirtland to the Missouri Plains, where they again bought land and farmed. And they were thrifty and they were communist and neighborly in their work and they began to prosper. But here he created a goon squad and armed them. They were called the Danites. And he began to set up pickets against any investigation of his community. It was his and his alone. And it was during this period of time that the angel spoke to him about the fact that though marriage is sacred, a man and woman are sealed for life. He was allowed many wives, the leader exerting his power. And finally, the militia of Missouri forced Joseph Smith out, and they went to southern Illinois to a town called Nauvoo. And there, because he could deliver 1,500 votes, the Democratic governor of Illinois gave him a charter which made him literally the field general, the commander-in-chief, the Führer of this little community. But finally, his power went beyond what the community could sustain. Not only was there polygamy, and all that that meant in terms of the traditional American way, but there was also the act by which he suppressed and destroyed the local press, because the Nauvoo Inquirer began to publish articles which raised questions about his apostleship, his leadership. And finally, the governor had to threaten him with an investigation. And he summoned his militia, and he paraded them in Nauvoo, and he said to them, this has been recorded, "Will you follow me to the death?" And the answer was, aye. "'Tis well you said so. For had you not promised to follow me to the death, I would have left you and found myself a nobler people. I, the leader, the need of the leader, the threat of the leader to leave, enough to bind you forever to the leader." The final denouement of Joseph Smith's life, because history never repeats itself, is different than that of Guyana. Joseph Smith fled into the night. But he only crossed the river. He couldn't get far enough away before the disciples came to him, the leaders, the lieutenants, and said, "You can't leave this way. We'll be lynched. You have to come back." Caught, trapped by his own dream, he returns to Nauvoo, and the governor sends down investigators who bring him back to Carthage, Illinois, where he was put under house arrest, and that night he was lynched, he and his brother, by a number of the townspeople of Carthage. Lynched, not having resorted to mass suicide or to war, becomes the martyr around which Brigham Young and the survivors build Mormonism, lead their covered wagons out to Utah, to their Zion. And today there are 3 million Mormons. We think of them as responsible and respectable citizens, among the most conservative element in our population. Ambassadors and senators and members of the House of Representatives and doctors and lawyers and everybody but Indian chiefs have come out of the Mormons, and they are an established religious group. A cult is simply a group of people who are serious about their religious beliefs. Now, you have to say lahavdil between certain sets of beliefs and other sets of beliefs, but that's the only difference. Judaism has had cults, and some of these cults, like the Pharisees, have been among the most formative elements in the development of our religious tradition. And if you want to or care to speculate about what will happen to the People's Temple now, I would suggest to you that it will go on. Perhaps it will go on led by people who never knew Jim Jones or were not part of the original People's Temple. But again, I commend to you history, our own history in this case. In the 17th century, right after one of the most terrible persecutions the Jews were ever to endure, when the Cossacks emerged out of the Ukraine and just killed one out of every three Jews who lived in Eastern Europe under the Bogdan Khmelnytsky, a messiah arose among our people by the name of Shabtai Tzvi. He was a Turkish Jew, lived in Smyrna. And Shabtai Tzvi promised that the end of the world was at hand, that the terrible devastations which had occurred were simply the wars of Gog and Magog, Armageddon, signs of the birth pangs of the Messiah. And the people began to acclaim him Messiah. And from all over Europe and Africa, Jews came to Jerusalem, where he had moved, to be there when the Messianic age would dawn. For a while, the Ottoman Turks were rather patient with Shabtai Tzvi. But then, as people began to emerge and come by the tens of thousands, they began to worry that he would raise an army and be a destructive force. So he was imprisoned, and ultimately he was given the choice between conversion to Islam and death. And so the Messiah committed the most unmessianic of all acts. The Messiah of the Jews became a Muslim. And you would think that would be enough to convince everyone and anyone that he was not the Messiah. But throughout the Jewish world, for centuries, literally, groups of Jews continued to worship in the Sabbatarian tradition and to proclaim Shabtai Tzvi as the Messiah. He had converted only to go into the darkness in order to bring out of the darkness light. He was a law unto himself, and showing us to what degradation he was willing to go in order to proclaim the salvation of God. Messiah will be resurrected. The tomb is not empty. Until the 20th century, there was a group in Constantinople of Jews called the Donme, who continued to worship Shabtai Tzvi as the great founder, leader, and Messiah. People's cult will not die so easily, even after it has been exposed to the most crude commercialization, you know, that we're going to see as books by the survivors and all kinds of stories begin to appear. It'll go on. It'll not become a major religion. And my hope is that, saddened by this experience, because all of us have been saddened by this evidence of human culpability and human credulity, and how really irrational we are as human beings, I hope all of us will learn to say lahavdil, to recognize that it does matter where we belong and in what tradition we raise our children, and that at the very center of our being, there lies a set of values on which we gamble our lives. Values which give meaning, coherence, direction, a sense of redemption to our lives. We're all religious. And we need to find in our religious institutions confirmation, encouragement, sensitivity as to these values. One of the things that worries me most about our times is not the cults, as they call them. The cults appealed to the very few. It's a matter really of timing when somebody in terrible emotional need turns to one of the cults. What disturbs me about our time is that the mainline traditions, responding to the convulsions, to future shock, responding to our increasing sense that life is beyond us, are turning more and more to authority, turning back more and more to traditionalism, turning back more and more to Stegeschrieben. This is the way, it's the only way. This is the truth, I tell you it's the truth. This is the truth because I tell you that's the truth. That we're giving up on that which was unique in modern religious faith, which lies at the heart of Protestantism, of liberal Judaism, and of most of the liberal religious movements of the 19th and 20th century. The affirmation that you have the right and the need, the God-given right and need, to be discriminating in your commitments, to make up your own mind. And that even as you make up your own mind, you must recognize that there is no absolute certainty that you are right. You will gamble your life on certain values, but there is no way of proving that those values are right. And that recognition is the beginning of humility. And the religious man who is also a humble man can hold on to principle without being a missionary, can hold on to commitment without becoming a fanatic. Because he or she recognizes that what is right for them, they must do. But they cannot impose their principles by force upon others. L'havdil. Chavdil bin Kodesh Lachol, there always has to be a separation made between those religious movements which consecrate life and those religious movements which are destructive of life. Religion, if you learn nothing else from this experience but this, religion is not good. Religion is not bad. Religion simply is. Amen.